been a guarantee of intellectual freedom. It looks as if it's being torn down. Lyra ran her hands through her hair. She kept thinking about the man she'd never heard of till then. The man with the three-legged hyena demon, who had been so determined to get her into his power when she was less than a year old.
That Bonneville man, she said. Was he part of the other side too? Is that why you wanted me?
An expression of contempt and disgust passed over Alice's face, just for a moment.
He was a complicated man, in a complicated situation, said Hannah. He seems to have been a spy, but an independent one, like an independent scholar. He was originally an experimental theologian, a physicist, and entirely on his own he'd penetrated to the heart of the Magisterium's Geneva headquarters and discovered all kinds of things. An extraordinary amount of material. It was in the rucksack that Malcolm rescued.
Stole, he said.
All right, stole. And Malcolm brought it all back to Oxford. But Bonneville had become a sort of renegade. He was psychotic, or obsessed, or something. He was obsessed with you as a baby for some reason.
I think he wanted to use you as a bargaining chip, said Dr. Polstead. But then, well, at the end he just seemed mad, deranged.
Lyra was astonished at the depth of pain in his face. He was looking directly at Alice, who was returning his gaze with a similar expression.
Dr. Polstead seemed unable to speak for a moment. He looked down at the carpet. Alice said huskily,
"This is another reason it's been hard to tell you, dear. You see, Bonneville raped me. He might have done more, but Malcolm came to my rescue, and, well, he did the only thing he could do. We was at the end of our strength. We thought we was at the end of our lives. Everything was so horrible, and,
She couldn't say any more. The demon Ben put his head on her lap, and she stroked his ears with a trembling hand. Lyra wanted to put her arms around her, but she couldn't move. Pan was stock still by her feet.
"The only thing he could do?"
she whispered. Malcolm's demon Aster said,
"Malcolm killed him."
Lyra couldn't speak. Dr. Polstead was still looking down at the floor. He rubbed the heel of his hand across his eyes. Alice said,
"You was bundled up in the boat, and he didn't want to leave you there alone, so Aster stayed with you. And Malcolm came up to the place where Bonneville was attacking me. And Aster stayed with you."
"You separated," Lyra said. "And you killed him."
"I hated every second of it."
"How old were you?"
11.
Just a little younger than Will, she thought, and the alethiometer had told her that he was a murderer. She looked at Dr. Polstead now, with eyes that seemed never to have seen him before. She imagined a stocky, ginger-haired boy killing an experienced secret agent. And then she saw another pattern, too. The man Will had killed had been a member of the Secret Service of his country. Were there other correspondences and echoes waiting to be discovered? The alethiometer could tell her. But oh, how long it would take. How quickly she would have done it once. Her fingers racing her mind as she flicked the hands around the dial and stepped unhesitatingly down the rungs of linked meanings into the darkness where the truth lay. Hannah said, "And we must think about keeping that safe, too."
Lyra blinked.
"The alethiometer? How did you know I was thinking about that?"
Her fingers were moving.
"Oh," she said, "I'll have to hide everything. I'll have to suppress every movement, every word. I had no idea, not the slightest flicker of an idea about all this. I don't know what to say."
"Pantalaimon will help you." But Hannah didn't know about the strain that existed between them these days. Lyra had told no one about that. Who would understand it, after all? "It's getting late," said Dr. Polstead. "If we want any dinner, Lyra, we'd better be getting back into town."
Lyra felt as if a week had passed. She stood up slowly and embraced Hannah, who held her tightly and kissed her. Alice stood up and did the same, and Lyra kissed her in return. "This is an alliance now," said Hannah. "Don't ever forget that."
"I won't," said Lyra. "Thank you. I'm still reeling, frankly. So much I just didn't know."
"And that's our fault," said Dr. Polstead. "We'll have to make it up to you. But we will. Are you dining in hall tonight?"
No, I must eat with the servants. The master made that very clear."
He and Lyra left Hannah's house and began to walk back towards the city centre, through the streets of Jericho, still busy with shoppers, where the well-lit shopfronts shone warm and safe.
"Lyra," he said, "I hope you won't forget that my name is Malcolm, and Mrs. Lonsdale is Alice."
"That'll take some getting used to."
"I expect many things will. This servant business. It's deliberately designed to humiliate you. There isn't a single scholar who doesn't value your presence among them. Even though I'm part of Durham now, I know that full well."
He said that several voices had told him that my dining in hall and so on was no longer appropriate.
"He's lying. If anybody did say that to him, it wasn't one of the scholars."
"Anyway, if what he wants to do is humiliate me," she said, "it'll fail. It's no humiliation at all to eat with my friends. They're as much family as anything else. If that's what he thinks of my family, so much the worse for him."
"Good." They said nothing for a minute or so.
Lyra thought she would never feel easy in the presence of this Malcolm, no matter what he'd done 19 years before. Then he said something that made her feel even more awkward.
Lyra? I think you and I have something else to discuss, haven't we?"
Chapter 8. Little Clarendon Street.
"Demons," she said quietly. He could hardly hear her.
"Yes," he said. "Did you have as big a shock as I did the other night?"
"I think I must have done. Does Hannah know that you can separate?"
"Yes. But it's not something we talk about. Alice knows too, but no one else. And she'll never say a word. What about you?"
"No one in this world knows," she said.
Then she swallowed hard and said,
"The witches of the north, they can separate from their demons. There was a witch called Serafina Pacala, who was the first I knew about. I saw her demon and spoke to him a long time before I saw her."
"I met a witch once, with her demon, during the flood."
"And there's a city with an Arabic name, a ruined city, inhabited by demons without people."
"I think I've heard of that too. Wasn't sure whether to believe it."
They walked on a little further. "But there's something else," Lyra began to say, and at the same moment he said, "I think there's..."
"Sorry," she said, "you go first. Your demon saw Pantalaimon, and he saw her, only he wasn't sure who she was till yesterday."
"In Alice's room?"
"Yes, only... oh, this is so difficult."
"Look behind," he said. She turned and saw what he'd already felt, both demons walking along together, heads close, talking intensely.
"Well,"
she said, "they were at the corner of Little Clarendon Street, which led after a couple of hundred yards to the broad avenue of St. Giles. Jordan College was no more than 10 minutes away. Malcolm said, "Have you got time for a drink? I think we need to talk a bit more easily than we can in the street."
"Yes," she said, "all right."
Little Clarendon Street had been adopted by Oxford's Jeunesse Dorée as a fashionable destination. Expensive clothes shops, chic coffee houses, cocktail bars, and coloured ambaric lights strung overhead made it seem like a corner of another city altogether. Malcolm couldn't have known what made tears come to Lyra's eyes at that point, though he did notice the tears. It was her memory of the deserted Chittagatse, all the lights blazing, empty, silent, magical, where she had first met Will. She brushed them away and said nothing. He led the way to a mock Italian cafe, with candles in straw-wrapped wine bottles, and red-checked tablecloths and travel posters in splashy colours. Lyra looked around, warily.
"It's safe here," Malcolm said quietly. "There are other places where it's risky to talk, but there's no danger in La Luna Caprese."
He ordered a bottle of Chianti, asking Lyra first if that was what she'd like, and she nodded. When the wine was tried and poured, she said,
"I've got to tell you something. I'll try and keep it clear in my head. And now I know about you and your demon, it's something I can tell you, but no one else. Only, I've heard so many things in the last couple of days, and my mind's in a whirl, so please, if I don't make sense, just stop me and I'll go over it again."
"Of course." She began with Pan's experience on the Monday night. The attack. The murder. The man giving him the wallet to take to Lyra. Malcolm listened in astonishment, though he felt no skepticism. Such things happened, as he knew well. But one thing seemed odd. "The victim and his demon knew about separating," he said.
"Yes," said Pan, at Lyra's elbow. "They weren't shocked like most people would be. In fact, they could separate too. She must have seen me up the tree when he was being attacked, and thought it would be all right to trust me, I suppose."
"So Pan brought the wallet back to me at St. Sophia's," Lyra went on.
"And that was when Asta saw me," Pan put in. "But other things got in the way, and we didn't have a chance to look at it till the next morning."
She pulled her bag up to her lap and took out the wallet, passing it to him unobtrusively. He noticed Pan's tooth marks, and noticed the smell, too, which Pan had called cheap cologne, though it seemed to Malcolm something other than that, something wilder. He opened the wallet and took out the contents one by one as she spoke. The Bodleian card, the university staff card, the diplomatic papers. All so familiar. His own wallet had held very similar papers in its time.
"He was coming back to Oxford, I think," Lyra said, "because if you look at the laissez-passer, you can trace his journey from Sin Kiang to here. He probably had gone on to the Botanic Garden if they hadn't attacked him."
Malcolm caught another faint trace of the scent on the wallet. He raised it to his nose, and something distant rang like a bell, or gleamed like the sun on a snowy mountaintop just for the fraction of a second, and then it was gone.
"Did he say anything else, the man who was killed?"
He addressed the question to Pan, and Pan thought hard before saying,
"No, he couldn't. He was nearly dead. He made me take the wallet out of his pocket and told me to take it to Lyra. I mean, he didn't know her name, but he said to take it to your... I think he thought we could be trusted because he knew about separating."
"Have you taken this to the police?"
"Of course. That was almost the first thing we did next morning," Lyra said. "But when we were waiting in the police station, Pan heard one of the policemen speak." "He was the first killer, the one who wasn't wounded," said Pan. "I recognized his voice. It was very distinctive."
"So we asked about something quite different and then left," Lyra went on.
"We just thought we shouldn't give the wallet to the very man who'd killed him."
"Sensible," said Malcolm.
"Oh, and there's another thing. The man who was cut on the leg, he's called Benny Morris."
"How do you know that?"
"I know someone who works at the mail depot, and I asked him if there was anyone there who'd hurt his leg. He said yes, there was a big ugly man called Benny Morris who sounds just like the man we saw."
"And what then?"
"In the wallet," Lyra said carefully, "there was a left luggage key. You know, sort you get with those lockers at the station."
"What did you do with that?"
"I thought we ought to go and get whatever was in it. So..."
"Don't tell me you did."
"Yes, because he'd sort of entrusted it to us, the wallet, and what was in it. So we thought we ought to go and look after it before the men who killed him realized and went to look for it themselves." "The killers knew he had some sort of luggage," said Pan, "because they kept asking each other if he'd had a bag, if he dropped it, were they sure they hadn't seen it, and so on, as if they'd been told to expect one."
"And what was in the locker?" said Malcolm.
"A rucksack," Lyra said, "which is under the floorboards in my room in Jordan."
"It's there now," she nodded. He picked up his glass and drained it in one, and then stood up. "Let's go and get it. While it's there, you're in great danger, Lyra, and that's no exaggeration. Come on."
5 minutes later, Lyra and Malcolm turned out of the Broad into Turl Street, the narrow thoroughfare where the main entrance to Jordan College stood under the lodge tower. They were halfway to the lodge when two men, dressed in anonymous workers' clothing, stepped out of the gate
and moved away towards the high street. One of them had a rucksack slung over his shoulder.
"That's it," said Lyra quietly.
Malcolm started to run after them, but Lyra instantly caught his arm. Her grip was strong.
"Wait," she said. "Keep quiet. Don't make them turn around. Just let's go inside."
"I could catch them. No need." The men were walking quickly away. Malcolm wanted to say several things, but held his tongue. Lyra was quite calm, and in fact seemed quietly satisfied about something. He looked again at the men, and followed her into the lodge, where she was talking to the porter.
"Yes, they said they were going to move your furniture, Lyra, but I just saw them go out. One of them was carrying something."
"Thanks, Bill," she said. "Did they say where they were from?"
"They gave me a card. Here it is."
She showed Malcolm the card. It said J. Cross Removals, with an address in Kidlington, a few miles north of Oxford.
"Do you know anything about J. Cross?" Malcolm said to the porter.
"Never heard of him, sir."
They climbed the two flights of stairs to a room. Malcolm hadn't set foot on this staircase since he was an undergraduate, but it didn't seem to have changed much. There were two rooms on the top floor on either side of a little landing, and Lyra unlocked the one on the right and switched the light on.
"Good God," said Malcolm. "We should have got here 5 minutes ago."
The room was in utter confusion. Chairs were overturned, books pulled out of shelves and thrown on the floor, papers in a scattered mass on the desk. The rug was pulled back and thrown in a corner, and a floorboard had been taken out.
"Well, they found it," said Lyra, looking at the floor. "It was under there. My favourite hiding place. Don't look so bitter. They were bound to search for a loose floorboard. I'd like to see their faces when they opened the rucksack, though."
And now she was smiling. For the first time for days, her eyes were free of shadows.
"What will they find?" Malcolm said.
"Two books from the History Faculty Library, all my last year's notes on economic history, a jersey that was too small for me, and two bottles of shampoo." Malcolm laughed. She pushed aside a battered old smoke leaf tin and looked through the books on the floor before handing two of them up to him.
"These are in the rucksack. I couldn't read them."
"This one looks like Anatolian," said Malcolm. "Some kind of botanical text. And this one's in Tajik. Oh, well.
What else?" From among the mass of papers spread all over the desktop and half across the floor, Lyra picked out a cardboard folder very similar to several others. Malcolm sat down to open it.
"And I'll just look in the bedroom," Lyra said, and went across the landing.
The folder was labelled in Lyra's hand. Malcolm supposed that she'd taken her own papers out and put the dead man's in, and so it proved. They seemed to be a sort of diary written in pencil. But he'd got no further than that when Lyra came back with a battered old smoke leaf tin, containing a dozen or so miniature cork-stoppered bottles and some little cardboard boxes.
"This was in the rucksack too," she said, "but I've no idea what's in them."
"Specimens?"
"Lyra, that was clever, but this is real danger you're in. They already know you are, somehow, and they know you know about the murder at least, and they'll soon know that you got the contents of the rucksack. I'm not sure you should stay here."
"I've got nowhere else to go," she said, "except St. Sophia's, and they probably know about that, too."
She wasn't looking for sympathy. It was said matter-of-factly. The look he remembered so well from when he taught her, that expression of blank, insolent obstructiveness, was lurking somewhere at the back of her eyes.
"Well, let's think about that," he said. "You could stay with Hannah, but that would be dangerous for her, wouldn't it? They must know we're connected. In any case, I think her sister is coming to spend Christmas with her, and there wouldn't be room.
Have you got any friends you could stay with?"
"There are people I've spent Christmas with before, but that was because they invited me. I've never asked. It would look wrong if I did it now, and, I don't know, I just wouldn't want to put anyone..."
"Well, it's clear that you can't stay here."
"And this is where I used to feel safest of all."
She looked lost. She picked up a cushion and held it close with both arms around it. Malcolm thought, why isn't she holding her demon like that? And that brought into focus something he'd noticed without seeing it clearly. Lyra and Pantalaimon didn't like each other. He felt a sudden lurch, as of surprise, and pitied them both.
"Look," he said, There's my parents' pub in Godstow, the Trout. I'm certain you could stay there, well, at least over the vacation.
Could I work there?
You mean, Malcolm is a little nonplussed. You mean, is it quiet enough to study?
No, she said more scornfully than her eyes suggested she meant. Work in the bar or the kitchen or something, to pay for my keep.
He saw how proud she was, and how shaken she'd been by the master's revelation about the money that was not there.
Well, if you'd like to do that, I'm sure they'd love it, he said.
Good then, she said. How stubborn she was, he had more cause to know than most. But he wondered how many others had seen the loneliness in her expression when she wasn't guarding it.
And let's not waste time, he said. We'll go there this evening, as soon as you're ready.
Well, I've got to tidy. She waved at everything in the room. I can't leave it like this.
Just put the books on the shelves and the furniture back. Is the bedroom turned over as well?
Yes, all my clothes all over the floor. Bed upside down.
There was a catch in her voice, and a glitter in her eyes. This was an invasion, after all.
Tell you what, he said. I'll put the books back and the papers on your desk, and Alice and I can deal with the furniture in here. You go and put some clothes in a bag. Leave the bed. We'll tell Bill that the removal men were a couple of opportunistic thieves, and he should have had more sense than to let them in.
He took a cotton shopping bag from the coat hook behind the door.
Can I use this for the rucksack stuff?
Yes, of course. I'll go and get some clothes.
He picked up a book that lay on the floor.
Are you reading this? He said.
It was Simon Talbot's The Constant Deceiver.
Yes, she said. I'm not sure about it.
That should please him.
He put the three folders, the two books, and the handful of small bottles and boxes in the bag. Later that night, they'd be in Hannah's safe. He'd have to contact Oakley Street, the obscure division of the Secret Service to which he and Hannah both belonged, and then go to the Botanic Garden, where they must have been expecting the unfortunate Dr. Hassel to have returned by now, with these specimens, whatever they were. He stood up, and began putting the books on the shelves, and presently Lyra came through.
Ready? He said. I've just put the books anywhere. You'll have to sort them out later, I'm afraid.
Thanks. I'm glad you were with me when we came back. Fooling them with the rucksack trick is all very well, but I understood how disgusting it would feel to... I don't know. Her hands all over my clothes.
Pan had been talking quietly with Asta. No doubt she could tell him all about their conversation later, and no doubt Pan realized it, and no doubt Lyra did too.
Actually, Malcolm said, we won't say a word to Bill. He'd want to call the police, and we'd have to explain why he mustn't. So he'd remember it and wonder about it. Much better to say nothing. If he asks, they were removal men, but they had the wrong date.
And if the police did get involved with this, they'd put two and two together. They'd know I know about the murder. But how did they trace the rucksack anyway? Nobody was following us.
The other side's got an alethiometer.
They must have a good reader, then. This is a very specific address. It's hard to get that sort of detail. I'll have to assume I'm being watched all the time. How loathsome.
Yes, it is. But now let's get you up to Godstow.
She picked up the Constant Deceiver, made sure her bookmark was still in place, and put it in the rucksack to take with her. Mr. and Mrs. Polstead were not in the least put out when their son appeared with Lyra. They agreed at once to let her stay at the Trout, gave her a comfortable room, agreed that she could work in the bar or the kitchen, wherever she would be most useful, and altogether seemed the most agreeable parents in the world.
"After all, he took you away,"
said Mrs. Polstead, putting a dish of beef casserole in front of Lyra at the kitchen table.
"Only right he should bring you back. Nearly 20 years."
She was a large woman with something of Malcolm's warm colouring, and eyes that were bright blue.
"And I've only just heard about it," said Lyra. "Being taken away, I mean. I was too young to remember anything. Where is the priory? Is it very close?"
"Just across the river. But it's a ruin now. The flood destroyed so much, and it was simply too expensive to repair. Besides, a number of the sisters died that night. There wouldn't have been enough of them left to get it going again. You won't remember Sister Fenella? Or Sister Benedicta? No, you were far too young."
Lyra, mouth full, shook her head.
"Well, Sister Benedicta was in charge," Mrs. Polstead went on. Sister Fenella looked after you most of the time. Oh, she was the sweetest old lady you could ever meet. Malcolm loved her dearly. He was devastated when he came back and found she was gone. Oh, I thought I'd never forgive him for making me worry so much. Just vanishing like that. Of course, we thought you must be drowned. You too, and Alice. And one good thing was that his canoe was gone. He might have had time to get in that, we thought. And we clung to that hope till he came back, all knocked about and shot and bruised and exhausted. Shot, said Lyra. The casserole was very good, and she was hungry, but she was even hungrier to hear everything Malcolm's mother could tell her. Shot in the arm? Oh, he still got the scar. And so worn out, completely drained. He slept for, 3 days. He was ill for a while, actually. All that filthy flood water, I suppose.
How's that casserole? Like another potato?
Thank you, it's delicious. What I don't understand is why I never knew about this. I mean, I wouldn't remember anyway, but why didn't anyone tell me? Good question. I suppose at first the problem was just looking after you. Problem for the college, I mean. Mouldy old place full of scholars. Never had a child running around. And none of them knew what had happened. And Alice wasn't going to tell them. What did Mal tell you about when they took you to Jordan with Lord Asriel?
I've only just heard for the first time this afternoon. And I'm trying to adjust. You see, I only ever knew Alice as Mrs. Lonsdale. She was always there when I was little, always keeping me clean and tidy and teaching me manners. I thought, well, I don't know what I thought. Suppose I thought she'd always been there.
Lord, no. I'll tell you how I know about it. The old master of Jordan, old Dr. Carn, asked me and Reg to come in and see him. That would have been maybe 6 months after the flood. We didn't know what it could be about, but we put on our best clothes and went there one afternoon. It was in the summer. He gave us tea in the garden and explained all about it. It seems that Mal and Alice had done what they set out to do and taken you to Lord Asriel, where they thought you'd be safe. Well, I never heard of anything so blooming reckless in all my life, and I let Mal know how senseless I thought he'd been. But I was proud of him, really, and I still am. Don't you dare tell him, mind. Anyway, it seems that Lord Asriel claimed that protection thing. Sanctuary.
Scholastic sanctuary.
That's it. On your behalf. And he told the master he'd have to make you into a scholar so you'd be properly entitled to it. Then Dr. Carn looked at Mal and Alice, half-drowned, worn out, filthy dirty, bleeding, and said, "What about these two?" And Lord Asriel said, "Treasure them." And then he left. So then Dr. Carn set about doing that. He arranged for Mal to go to Radcliffe School, and paid for it, and then later on admitted him to Jordan as an undergraduate. Alice wasn't a great one for education, but sharp as a tack, very bright, very quick. The master offered her a place among the staff, and she soon took over looking after you. She married young, Roger Lonsdale, carpenter, lovely boy, decent, steady. He died in a building accident. Oh, she was widowed before she was 20. I don't know all that happened on that ruddy voyage to London in Malcolm's old canoe. He's never told me half of it. Says I'd be too frightened. But one thing was, him and Alice came back fast friends. Oh, inseparable they were, as far as it could happen, him being at school and all.
Weren't they before?
Oh, deadly enemies. She sneered at him, and he ignored her. Hated each other. Oh, she could be a bully. She's 4 years older, remember? And that's a lot at that age. She used to tease him, pick on him. Ooh, I had to tell her off once, but he never complained. Though he used to set his lips. Like this. When he took the dirty dishes into her to be washed. Then, that winter, they gave her a bit of work at the Priory. Helping out with you. Letting poor old Sister Fenella take it a little bit easier. Well, you made short work of that casserole. Like some more?
No, thanks. It was just what I wanted.
Baked plums. I put a bit of liqueur in with them.
Oh, sounds lovely. Yes, please.
Mrs. Polstead dished them up and poured double cream over them. Lyra looked to see if Pan had seen that. Before their coldness, he used to tease her about her appetite. But he was sitting on the floor talking to Mrs. Polstead's demon, a grizzled old badger. Mrs. Polstead sat down again. Malcolm's told me a bit about this new master of Jordan, she said. Oh, he's treated you badly.
Well, you see, I really can't tell if he has or not. I'm so confused. Things have been happening so quickly. I mean, if the money I was living on has run out, as he said, I can't challenge that, because I don't know anything apart from what he told me. Did, Malcolm tell you about the master making me leave my rooms?
It was the first time she'd referred to him as Malcolm, and it felt awkward for a moment.
Yes, oh, that was a wretched, shabby thing to do. That college is as rich as Alibaba. They didn't need your rooms for a ruddy student. Throwing you out of a place you'd lived in all your life?
Oh, all the same, he's in charge, and I don't know. There are so many complications, I'm sort of losing my grip. Thought I was more sure of things.
You stay here as long as you like, Lyra. There's plenty of room, and it'll be useful to have an extra pair of hands. The girl I was expecting to work over Christmas has decided to work in Boswell's instead. Yeah, good luck to her.
Well, I worked there 2 winters ago.
Oh, it was non-stop. They think it's glamorous at first. Perfumes and lotions and whatnot. But it's sheer hard work.
Lyra realized that she must have sold some of Miriam's father's products during her time at Boswell's. But since she didn't know Miriam then, she wouldn't have noticed. Suddenly, the world of undergraduate friendships, the calm and frugal life of St. Sophia's, seemed a long way away.
Now, let me help you with these dishes, she said,
and soon she was up to her elbows in soapy water and feeling very much at home. That night, Lyra had a dream about a cat on a moonlit lawn. At first, it didn't interest her, but then, with a start that nearly woke her up, and certainly woke Pantalaimon, she recognized Will's demon, Kiryava, who came directly across the grass and rubbed her head on the hand Lyra held out. Will had never known he had a demon, until she was torn away from his heart on the shores of the world of the dead, just as Pan was torn away from Lyra. And now, Lyra seemed to her dreaming self to be recalling things she knew from another time, or perhaps from the future, whose significance was as overpowering as the joy she and Will had felt together. The red building in the journal came into it too. She knew what it contained. She saw why she had to go there. That knowledge was part of everything she knew, immovably. It seemed in her dream memory only yesterday when all four of them had wandered together in the world of the Mulifer. And that time was surrounded, suffused, with such love that she found herself weeping in her dream, and woke with her pillow soaked with tears. Pan watched from close by, and didn't say a word. Lyra tried to recall every image from the dream, but it was vanishing by the second. All that was left was that intense, intoxicating, saturating love. Malcolm rang Hannah's doorbell. 2 minutes later, they were sitting by her fireside, and he was telling her about the murder, the wallet, the rucksack, and Lyra at the Trout. She listened without interrupting. He was good at recounting events, giving each its due weight, putting them in the most effective order. "What's in the bag?" she said.
"Aha," he said, and set it between his feet. "These papers, to begin with. I haven't had time to look, but I'll photogram them tonight. These two books, an Anatolian book on botany, and this." She took the other book. It was poorly bound and clumsily repaired, and the paper was coarse and fragile, and the typesetting amateurish. It bore the signs of much reading. The boards that covered it were greasy with handling. Several pages were dog-eared, and many bore penciled annotations in the same language as the text.
"It looks like poetry," she said, "but I don't know the language."
"It's Tajik," he told her, "and it's an epic poem called Jahan and Ruxana. I can't read all of it, but I recognize that much."
"And what's that other group of papers?"
It was Dr. Strauss's diary, the account of his journey into the desert of Karamakan.
"I think this is the key to the whole thing," said Malcolm. "I stopped at the Lamb and Flag on the way here and read this, and you should read it too. It won't take long."
She took the bundle of paper, intensely curious.
"And the poor man was a botanist, you say?"
I'll go to the Botanic Garden tomorrow, see what they can tell me. There were some little bottles in the rucksack. Here they are. And some boxes of what look like seeds, too.
She took one of the bottles, held it up to the light, sniffed it, and read the label. Ol-a-tajikyai. Ol-a-kajmiai. Not easy to read. Ol could be oil, I suppose. Oleum? R is rosa.
That's my guess, too.
And these are seeds, you think?
She rattled one of the little specimen boxes. I imagine so. I haven't had time to open them. Let's have a look.
The lid of the box was tight, and took a lot of persuading to open. Hannah tipped the contents carefully into her hand. A few dozen small seeds, irregular in shape and greyish-brown in colour. Malcolm read the label on the lid.
R. lopnorii. That's interesting. Do you recognise them?
They look like rose seeds. But I might be thinking that because of the other things. They do look like rose seeds, though. What's interesting?
The name of the variety. I suppose it's not surprising to find a botanist carrying seeds, but something's been nagging at my memory. I really think this is Oakley Street business.
So do I. I'll see Glenys on Saturday, Tom Nugent's memorial service. I'll speak to her then.
Good, said Malcolm. It's important enough to lie behind murder and theft, anyway. Hannah, what do you know about Lop Nor?
A lake, is it? Or is it a desert? Somewhere in China, anyway. Well, I've never been there, but I heard it mentioned a few months ago in connection with... What was it?
There's a scientific research station near there. Meteorology, mainly, but they cover a number of other disciplines as well. Anyway, they've lost a number of scientists, inexplicably. They just vanished.
I did hear rumours about dust, Malcolm said. I remember now. Charlie Capes told me about it.
Charles Capes was a priest in the hierarchy of the English Church, and secretly a friend of Oakley Street. His position was a risky one. There were severe penalties for apostasy, and there was no appeal from the verdicts of the ecclesiastical courts, which allowed only one defence, overpowering diabolical temptation. In passing information on to Oakley Street, Capes was risking his career, his freedom, and possibly his life.
So, the Magisterium is interested in Lop Nor, said Malcolm, and possibly roses, too.
You're going to take this material to the Botanic Garden?
Yes, but I'll photo all the papers first. And Hannah?
What?
We're going to have to tell Lyra all about Oakley Street. She's too vulnerable. It's time she knew where to find help and protection. Oakley Street could give her that.
I nearly told her this afternoon, she said.
Of course I didn't.
I think you're right, though, and we must. You know, this reminds me of that other rucksack all that time ago. One you brought me from Gerard Bonneville. So much material. I've never seen such a treasure trove. And her alethiometer.
Thinking about alethiometers, he said, I'm concerned that the other side managed to pinpoint Lyra and the rucksack so quickly. That's not usual, is it? She looked troubled.
It sort of confirms what we'd guessed, she said. People have been talking for months now about a new way of reading the alethiometer. Very unorthodox. Experimental, partly. The new way depends on abandoning the sort of single viewpoint perspective you have with the classical method. I can't explain exactly how it works, because the only time I tried it I was violently sick. But apparently, if you can do it, the answers come much more quickly, and you hardly need the books at all.
Are there many people using this new method?
None in Oxford, to my knowledge. The general feeling is against it. It's Geneva where most of the discoveries have been made. They've got a young man there who's brilliantly gifted. And you'll never get...
Lyra, does she use the new method?
Why, I think she's tried once or twice, but without much success.
And sorry, I interrupted you. What was it that I'd never guess?
The name of the young man in Geneva. It's Olivier Bonneville.
Chapter 9. The Alchemist. As soon as she'd read Strauss's journal, Hannah agreed with Malcolm that Oakley Street needed to see it as soon as possible. Accordingly, He spent much of the night photographing every one of the papers from Hassel's rucksack, together with the title page of each of the books. He put the rolls of film in his refrigerator and went to bed nearer 5 o'clock than 4. Before they fell asleep, Asta said, "Has she still got her gun?" Every Oakley Street agent of Hannah's rank had to take an unarmed combat course and pass a test on their marksmanship with a pistol once a year. Hannah looked like a mild, grey-haired academic, which is what she was, but she was armed, and she could defend herself.
"She keeps it in that safe of hers," said Malcolm. "I'm sure she'd prefer not to take it out."
"It should be closer at hand than that."
"Well, you tell her. I've tried."
"What are we going to do about Olivier Bonneville?"
"Can't do anything but speculate at the moment."
"A son. Bonneville might have had a son. One more thing to find out. We'll see what Oakley Street knows."
After breakfast, Malcolm delivered the rolls of film to a trusty technician for developing and walked along the high street to the Botanic Garden. It was a somber grey day, with the taste of rain in the air, and the lit windows of the administrative building glowed brightly against the bulk of a large yew behind it. The secretary told him at first that the director was busy and that he'd need an appointment, but as soon as he said that his visit concerned Dr. Roderick Hassel, her attitude changed. In fact, she looked shocked.
"Do you know where he is?"
she said, and her demon, a little Boston terrier, stood with hackles raised, uttering a hardly audible whine.
"Well, that's what I've come to discuss with the director."
"Of course, sorry. Excuse me."
She left her desk and entered an inner room, the demon scampering at her heels. A few moments later she came out and said,
"Professor Arnold will see you now."
"Thanks," said Malcolm, and went in. The secretary closed the door behind him. The director was a woman of 40 or so, blonde, slender, and fierce-looking. She was standing. A hummingbird demon hovered in the air over her shoulder before settling there.
"What do you know about Roderick Hassel?"
she said at once.
"Well, I was hoping you could tell me something about him." "All I know is what's in here," said Malcolm, and laid the shopping bag on the neatly ordered desk. "I found it at a bus stop, as if someone had forgotten it. There was no one nearby, and I waited for a few minutes to see if anyone would come back and claim it, but no one did. So I thought I'd better see who it belonged to. There's a wallet in there."
Professor Arnold found the wallet and looked at it briefly.
"And seeing that he's a member of your staff," Malcolm went on, "I thought I'd bring it here."
"A bus stop, you said? Where?"
"On the Abingdon Road, side heading into town."
"When?"
Yesterday morning."
She put the wallet down and took out one of the folders. After a quick glance at the contents, she did the same with the other two. Malcolm stood, waiting for her to speak. Finally, she looked at him. She seemed to be weighing him up.
"I'm sorry, my secretary didn't tell me your name," she said.
"She didn't ask me for it. Her name's Malcolm Polstead. I'm a scholar of Durham College. When I mentioned Dr. Hassel's name, though, she looked shocked. And now I have to say that you look the same. It is genuine, I take it, all this. University cards are real. There is a Dr. Hassel, and he is on your staff."
"I'm sorry, Doctor."
"Doctor?"
He nodded. "Dr. Polstead. But this has taken me aback. Please, sit down."
He sat in the chair facing the desk. She sat too and lifted the telephone.
"I need some coffee," she said,
and raised her eyebrows at Malcolm, who nodded.
"Could you bring us coffee for two, Joan, please?"
She picked up the wallet again, and took out cards, papers, money, and laid them all neatly on her blotter.
"Why didn't you—"
she began, and stopped, and began again.
"Did you think of taking this to the police?"
"The first thing I did was look in the wallet to find the name, and when I saw the card saying he worked here, I thought it would save time all round if I brought it here directly. Besides, I couldn't help being curious, because when I was looking through the wallet, I caught sight of the name of a place where I spent a little time myself, and I wondered what Dr. Hassel was researching."
Which place?"
"Lop Nor." Now she was more than interested. In fact, she was suspicious, even alarmed.
"What were you doing there?" she said. "I'm sorry. It sounded like an accusation."
"I was looking for a tomb,
I'm an historian, and the Silk Road has been one of my interests for a long time. I didn't find the tomb, but I did find some other things that made the journey worthwhile. May I ask what Dr. Hassel was doing in Central Asia?
Well, he's a botanist, of course. There's a research institute there. We support it together with the universities of Edinburgh and Leiden. He was working there.
Why there? I don't remember much in the way of plant life around Lop Nor. A few poplars, some grass, tamarisks, I think.
For one thing, the climatic conditions, thank you, Joan, just leave it there, aren't easy to replicate further north and west, especially here on the edge of a large ocean. Then there's the soil. There are some unusual minerals in it, and there's local knowledge. They grow flowers that just can't be grown anywhere else.
And Dr. Hassel, is he back in Oxford now? I'm just wondering, and it's none of my business, I know, why you're so alarmed.
I'm alarmed for him, she said. The fact is that he's missing. We thought he was dead.
Really? When did you begin to think that?
Some weeks ago. He vanished from the station.
The station?
We call it the station. The research institute at Tashbilak.
The place near Lop Nor. And he vanished. She was looking more and more uncomfortable. She tapped her fingers on the desk. Short nails, he noticed, and even a touch of dirt in them, as if she'd been botanizing when he arrived.
Look, Dr. Polstead, she said, I'm sorry to seem evasive. The thing is, communications with the station aren't quick or reliable. Obviously, our information about Dr. Hassel was wrong. It's good to have these things, very good, because it might mean that he's alive after all. But I'd have expected, if it was him that brought them to Oxford, of course, it would have been wonderful if he'd come here in person. I just can't imagine what anyone was doing leaving them at a bus stop. I'm sure he wouldn't do that. Someone else must have. I'm utterly perplexed. I hope he was. Thank you very much, Dr. Polstead, for bringing this in.
What will you do now?
You mean about this, these things?
She was frightened of something, and frightened separately of betraying the fact to him, a stranger. A demon had not moved from her shoulder, or closed his eyes, which gazed at Malcolm solemnly. Malcolm looked back, trying to seem bland and harmless and helpful. "It's about roses, isn't it?" he said. She blinked. The demon turned away and buried his face in her hair.
"Why'd you ask that?"
"Two things. One is the specimens, the seeds and the rose oil. The other is that battered book in the red cover. It's an epic poem in the Tajik language called Jahan and Roxana. It's about two lovers who search for a rose garden. Was Dr. Hassel investigating something to do with roses?"
Yes, he was, she said. I can't tell you any more because, I have to supervise dozens of projects, postgraduate theses, the work done here as well as what they do at Tashbilak and my own research as well.
She was one of the worst liars he'd ever met. He felt sorry for her. She was having to improvise a defense when she was in a state of shock. "I won't bother you any more," he said. "Thanks for explaining what you could. If, for any reason, you need to get in touch with me..." He laid one of his cards on the desk.
"Thank you, Dr. Polstead," she said, and shook his hand.
"Do let me know if you have any news. I feel as if I've got shares in Dr. Hassel now." He left the building and went to sit in the garden, where a little weak sunshine was gilding the bare stems of the shrubs, and where two young men were doing something horticultural near the glasshouses.
"Should have told her," said Asta.
"I know, but that would drag Lyra into it, and involve the police, and it was one of them who killed him."
"But the policeman wasn't acting officially, Mal, come on. The one Pan saw is corrupt. The police need to know what happened, and know about him."
"You're absolutely right. And I feel very bad about it.
But?"
"We'll tell her soon. Tell them soon."
"When?"
"When we've learned a little more."
"And how are we going to do that?"
"Not sure yet." Asta closed her eyes. Malcolm wished that Lyra hadn't taken the risk of getting the rucksack from the station alone. But who'd have been able to help her? Not him, clearly. Not then. Once you've witnessed a murder and decided against telling the police, you're really on your own.
and that set him thinking about her again. While Astor lay sphinx-like on the wooden seat beside him, eyes half-closed, Malcolm wondered how Lyra was getting on of the trout, and how safe she'd be there, and a dozen other questions gathered around one central one that he didn't want to look at yet. Had she completely changed from the sullen, contemptuous girl whose manner and tone had been so difficult to deal with when he was teaching her a few years before? She seemed to be much more hesitant, reticent, uncertain of herself. She looked lonely and unhappy, not to make too much of it. And there was a strange, cold relationship with her demon. But when they'd spoken in the little restaurant, she'd been almost confiding, almost friendly. And her pleasure in having concealed the things from the rucksack was like a little ripple of laughter, something almost carefree, delightful anyway. That central question wouldn't go away. He came back to it helplessly. He was conscious of his own ox-like clumsiness. He was conscious of all kinds of contrasts. His maturity and her youth. His bulk and her slenderness. His stolidity and her quickness. He could watch her for hours. Her eyes, large and long-lashed, a gloriously vivid blue, more expressive than anyone's he'd known. She was so young, but already he could see where the laughter lines, the lines of sympathy, the lines of concentration would gather in the years to come, and make her face even richer and more full of life. Already, on each side of her mouth, there was a tiny crease made by the smile that seemed to hover just under the surface, ready to flower into being. Her hair, dark, straw-coloured, shortish and untidyish, but always soft and shining. Once or twice when he was teaching her, bending to look over her shoulder at a piece of written work, he caught a faint scent from that hair, not of shampoo, but of young, warm girl, and drawn away at once. At that time, when they were teacher and pupil, anything like that was so wrong his mind shut it out before it had even fully formed. But 4 years later, was it still wrong to think about it? About Lyra now? Wrong to yearn to put his hands on either side of her face, on those warm cheeks, and bring it gently towards his? He'd been in love before. He knew what was happening to him. But the girls and women he'd loved in the past had been roughly his own age, mostly. In the one exception, the difference went the other way. Nothing he knew was any help in this situation. And she was in such danger and difficulty at the moment that bothering her with his own feelings would be unforgivable. But there it was. He, Malcolm Polstead, aged 31, was in love with her. It was impossible to think that she could ever love him. The quiet of the large garden, the distant conversation of the two young botanists, the regular scraping of their hose, the purring of his demon, all combined with his lack of sleep and his troubled heart, to make it tempting to close his eyes and hope to dream of Lyra. So he stood up and said to Astor, "Come on, let's go and do some work." At 11 that night, Mr. and Mrs. Polstead were talking quietly in bed. It was the second evening of Lyra's stay at the Trout. She was in her bedroom. The girl who helped in the kitchen, the potboy, the assistant barman had all gone home. There were no guests.
"I can't make her out," said Reg Polstead.
"Lyra? What do you mean?"
"Well, she seems perfectly cheerful on the surface, full of, you know, chatter, friendliness. Then sometimes she'll fall quiet and her whole face changes. It's as if she's just had some bad news."
"No," said his wife, "it's not like that. She doesn't look shocked. She looks lonely. She looks as if she's used to it and doesn't expect anything else.
But that's what she is.
Melancholy."
"She doesn't hardly ever speak to that demon either," he said. "It's as if they're two separate people."
"Oh, she was such a happy baby. Laughing, singing, full of fun.
Mind you, that was before... You know, before Malcolm's voyage. Well, he was different after that. So was Alice.
But you'd expect them to be more affected, seeing as they were older. She was just a baby. They don't remember things. And she is being badly treated by that college. It's her home. You'd think they'd take better care. Not surprising she's a bit subdued.
I wonder if she's got any relatives. Malcolm says her father and mother are both long dead.
Well, if she's got any uncles or aunts or cousins, I don't think much of them, said Mrs. Polstead.
Why?
Well, they should have got in touch a long time ago. It's an unnatural life for a young girl, cooped up with a lot of old scholars.
Maybe she has got relatives and they don't care about her. She'd be better off without them in that case.
Possibly.
Tell you one thing, though. Oh, she's a hard worker.
I'll have to find something particular for her to do. She does Pauline's couple of jobs quicker and better than Pauline, and Pauline's going to feel shoved aside unless I give Lyra something different.
We don't need her to work. She could stay as a guest. Welcome, far as I'm concerned. Oh, me too, love, but it's not for us. It's for her. She's got a college work, but she needs to feel useful.
I'm trying to think of something extra. Something that wouldn't get done at all if she didn't do it. Yeah, maybe you're right. I'll have a think. Night, sweetheart.
He turned over. She read a detective story for 5 minutes, found her eyelids drooping, and put the light out. Hannah Ralph didn't know it, but Lyra had been experimenting with the new method of reading the alethiometer. This new method wasn't a matter of public knowledge, because there was little public discussion of the alethiometer, but among the small groups of experts, it was a topic of excited speculation. The instrument in her possession was the one Malcolm had found in Gerard Bonneville's rucksack, and then thrust in among the baby Lyra's blankets when Lord Asriel had handed her to the Master of Jordan. The Master had given it to Lyra when she was 11, and she'd taken it with her on the great adventure in the Arctic and beyond. At first, she learned to read it intuitively, as if it was the most natural thing in the world. But before very long, she lost the power to do that, and she was left unable to see all the connections and similarities that had once been so clear beneath the symbols on the dial. The loss of that power was painful. It was a consolation, though a poor thin one, to know that by diligent study she'd be able to regain some of the ability to read it. But she'd always need the books in which generations of scholars had set down their discoveries about the symbols and the links between them. The contrast, though. It was like losing the power to fly through the air like a swift and being compensated with a crutch to help her limp along the ground. And that contributed to her melancholy. Mrs. Polstead was right. Melancholy was Lyra's state of mind these days, and since her rift with Pan, she'd had no one to talk to about it. How absurd it was that the two of them were one person, and yet they found it so hard to talk together, or even endure each other's company in silence. More and more, she found herself whispering to a phantom, to her idea of what Will was like now in that unreachable world of his. So the new style of alethiometric technique had come as a welcome distraction. It had spread by rumor. No one knew from whom or from where, but there were stories about dramatic advances in understanding, of a revolution in theory, of sensational feats of readership, where the books were simply redundant, superfluous. And Lyra privately began to experiment. On their second night at the Trout, she was sitting in bed, knees drawn up, blankets around her against the cold, the alethiometer in her loosely cupped hands. The low, sloping ceiling of the bedroom, the wallpaper with its pattern of little flowers, the old, worn rug beside the bed, they felt comfortably familiar already, and the gentle yellow light from the naphtha lamp beside her made the room feel warmer than a thermometer would have shown. Pan was sitting beneath the lamp. In the old days, he would have been curled up warmly between her breasts.
"What are you doing?" he said.
His tone was hostile.
"I'm going to try the new method again."
"Why? Last time it made you sick."
"I'm exploring, trying things out."
"I don't like the new method, Lyra."
"But why?"
"Because when you do it,
You look as if you're lost. I can't tell where you are. And I don't think you know where you are. You need more imagination.
What?
If you had more imagination, it would be better. But what are you saying? You said I haven't got any imagination? You're trying to live without it, that's what I'm saying. It's those books again. One of them saying it doesn't exist, the other saying it doesn't matter anyway.
No, no. Well, if you don't want my opinion, don't ask me about it.
But I didn't...
She didn't know what to say. She felt powerfully upset. He was just looking at her, expressionlessly.
What should I do? She said.
She meant about us. But in response, he said,
Well, you have to be able to imagine. But in your case, that's not easy, is it? I really have no... Pan, I just don't know what you're talking about. It's as if we're speaking different languages. It doesn't connect with...
What were you going to look up, anyway?
I'm not sure anymore. You've confused me. But something's wrong with things. I suppose I was going to see if I could find out what it is.
He looked away, and slowly moved his tail from side to side. And then he turned away altogether, and sprang onto the old chintz-covered armchair, and curled up to sleep.
No imagination. Trying to live without imagination. She had never in her life thought about what her imagination might be.
If she had, she might have supposed that that aspect of herself resided more in Pan, because she was practical, matter of fact, down to earth.
But how did she know that?
Other people seemed to regard her as being those things, or at least they treated her as if they did. She had friends she would have called imaginative. They were witty, or they said surprising things, or they daydreamed a lot. Wasn't she like that? Evidently not. She had no idea it would hurt so much to be told she had no imagination. But Pan had said it was because of those books. It was true, the narrative of the Hypocharasmians treated with contempt the characters who were artistic, or who wrote poetry, or who spoke about the spiritual. Did Gottfried Brander mean that imagination itself was worthless? Lyra couldn't remember if he ever mentioned it directly. She'd have to look through the book and see. As for Simon Talbot in The Constant Deceiver, his own imagination was on display throughout, in a kind of charming but heartless play with the truth. The effect was dazzling, dizzying, as if there were no responsibilities, no consequences, no facts. She sighed. She was holding the alethiometer loosely in both hands, letting her thumbs move across the knurled wheels, sensing the familiar weight, half watching the reflection of the lamplight move as she turned it this way and that.
"Well, Pan, I tried," she said, but very quietly. "And so did you for a bit. You just couldn't keep going. You're not really interested. What are we going to do? We can't go on like this. Why do you hate me so much? Why do I hate you? Why can't we stand being with each other?"
She was no longer sleepy, just wide awake and unhappy.
"Well," she whispered, "it won't make any difference now."
She sat up a little, held the alethiometer more purposefully. There were 2 points of difference between the new method and the classical one. The first had to do with the placing of the hands on the dial. The classical method required the reader to frame a question by pointing each of the hands at a different symbol, and thus define precisely what it was they wanted to know. But with the new method, all 3 hands were pointed at 1 symbol, chosen by the reader. This was felt by classically trained readers to be grossly unorthodox and disrespectful of tradition, besides being unstable. Instead of the steady and methodical inquiry made possible by the firmly based triangle of the 3 hands, the single anchor hold of the new method allowed a wild and unpredictable chaos of meanings to emerge as the needle darted rapidly from place to place. The 2nd point of difference had to do with the attitude of the reader. The classical method required a careful, watchful, but relaxed state of mind, which took a good deal of practice to manage. After all, Part of the reader's attention had to be available for consulting the books which laid out the multiple meanings of each symbol. The new method, on the other hand, didn't need the books at all. The reader had to abandon control and enter a state of passive vision where nothing was fixed and everything was equally possible. This was the reason why both Hannah and Lyra had had to stop soon after beginning their experiments with it. They'd felt horribly seasick. Now, sitting in bed and thinking about it, Lyra felt apprehensive. "Could it go wrong?" she whispered. "And I could get lost. Never come back." Yes, that was a risk. Without a fixed perspective or a solid place to stand, it might be like drowning in a wild sea. In a spirit of mingled desperation and reluctance, she turned the wheels until all three hands pointed to the horse. She didn't